The tents, the roadside trash, as you know, if you've driven to work right this morning, they are still there. And we know that a lot of it is being caused by the same repeat offenders. And we're still trying to figure out what to do. Cairo's Hannah Scott talked with a pair of King County judges to talk about this. What did they tell you, Hannah?
So for King County judges Johanna Bender and Veronica Alsea Gavan, the bottom line is that it's just not that simple. First, they can only deal with cases that are actually filed and brought to them. So some of this does lie with prosecutors. Judge Galvan says, on top of that, you have to remember,
in Washington State, there is a presumption of release. In other words, it is presumed that people will be released unless it can be shown that they're going to interfere with the administration of justice, they're not going to appear in court, or they are going to be a danger of committing a violent offense within the community.
So she's talking about pre-trial situations, and when someone comes in front of them, they look at those three things and then have to decide whether that person meets the bar for lockup or can go to what's known as a less restrictive alternative. In Seattle, that's the Community Corrections Alternative Placement Programs. It's a basic program where they are required to, the person is required to check in daily, and then they get court date reminders from DOC. Then there's the enhanced version of that.
In that enhanced, you have social workers, you have treatment providers, you report daily, but you have access to individuals who can help you potentially with housing and with these other things.
So that, again, is in that pretrial situation, kind of the same situation we hear about with shelters, right? We have those enhanced services shelters. Same thing for when you're arrested for these types of offenses. They try to connect you with services, housing, and everything else. But right now, that program is only available in Seattle, not in Kent, where Judge Bender works. A resource, she says, is absolutely necessary, especially given the circumstances of many of those who come in front of her.
One of the things we have learned that seems to be just unimpeachably true is that most of the people who are in the criminal justice system, especially who are in the criminal justice system as repeat offenders, are here because they are struggling with a behavioral health disorder, with mental illness, with substance abuse, often with trauma issues in their lives. And so if we don't give them the support that they need to address those underlying challenges, they are very likely to reoffend.
And she says the county has the numbers to back this up. Now, this is separate from that recent prolific offenders report.
The Familiar Faces program, which is a program of the executive branch, just did an audit of the most frequent utilizers of the county jail. Folks booked at least four times in a 12-month period. I believe they found that approximately 98% of those folks had an identifiable and often untreated mental health and or chemical dependency disorder.
So the prolific offenders report, I think, looked at 100 people that were frequent users of the jail. This particular one was like 1,200 people. And again, almost all of them were found to have mental health or substance abuse disorders. And Judge Galvan says that's a huge challenge because when we start talking about suspects with substance abuse and or mental health issues, competency comes into play.
Because you can't proceed to trial with an individual who's not competent. That's difficult. And it's compounded when you have intersections, right, of substance abuse and mental health. So yes, competency and the ability to proceed to trial, we've seen a significant increase in some of these issues. Civil commitment proceedings as well, ITA, over the last 10 years has increased.
More than doubled.
More than doubled.
So that's involuntary treatment when we're talking about civil commitments, right? When you haven't done a felony or something and you can be referred.
You can be required.
Yeah, for 90 to 180 days, whether you go for what's called a restoration, right, to get you back to where maybe you can come and stand trial to find you competent. That is a big problem because even that is not working.
Right now, we're finding that about a third of the people in King County who are released on less restrictive orders come back to the hospital acutely psychotic just within the period of the less restrictive order. So just within that 90 days or that 180 days, a third of them are coming back psychotic. So we're not doing a good enough job of the warm handoff between the hospital and the court system and the outpatient community mental health provider. That is not said to cast blame on any of those stakeholders. It is a system that is stressed to the point of acute crisis.
So a lot of this is wishful thinking, it sounds like, thinking that you can, in 120 days or whatever it is, bring someone back to competency such that they could stand trial.
there's no handoff, right? There's not this assembly line where you go from the court system and then you go to the hospital and then you go to a treatment outpatient facility where you can maybe get the follow through to go back in front of the court system. You remember we talked, I don't know, it was a month ago or so about the gentleman who was accused of trying to throw the woman off of the bridge,
yeah.
Right? So I had done some investigation on that. That was a Seattle municipal court situation, but I did all the digging. That gentleman had been released. Remember, he had that big record. He had gone in and out for these competency. He was never found competent, so they always dismissed the charges because there's nothing that the judge can do in that situation. But they referred for a possible, not the restorative, but for involuntary commitment assessment. Mm-hmm. There's no follow through. The judges, once that's done.
So they just sign a document and nobody's in charge of carrying it out?
They sign it. They hand it off to the hospital. Then it's up to the hospital, DSHS, whatever. They have to do that. And there's no, the judge and the DSHS and whomever they refer to never, ever communicate on that person again.
Why do you release somebody who tried to throw someone off a bridge, even if they're incompetent? Right? Isn't the incompetency maybe the reason you've got to keep them locked up because they're a danger to people?
It's not the court's position. It's not their decision. They have to have that psychiatrist person come in and find them incompetent. And then as far as the jail is concerned, pretrial, they're only legally allowed to hold that person in the jail for 72 hours. It's up to the hospital and for the mental health.
Was there any question about the act itself, the attempt to throw the person off the bridge? See, if there's no question about that, who cares what the psychologist says? You have, for whatever reason, someone who's too dangerous to be roaming free on the streets, don't you?
If they're not competent, there is nothing that the court can do.
Well, okay. And is that just the general law of the land in America? Or
if you're not competent to stand trial. And so that's one of the big gaping holes here,
so
right? In that particular case, he was also not eligible for restoration, that 90 to 180 day situation where he could go and get brought back to a competency level because they had tried so many times before it didn't work. I don't know what the solution is to that. Again, that's not something these two judges dealt with, but it's an overall theme that we're having in the state, especially there's a shortage, there are gaps, there's lack of communication between all of these courts to the hospital and down the line.
But then it sounds like there's a law that needs to be changed here, because what you're saying is even if we were to build additional hospital facilities to provide treatment, there's still no way you could compel someone like that to go there.
Well, and I think that you have to fine tune what's going on. There's a breakdown in communication would be my takeaway between what goes on from the courts again to the mental health facilities. But remember that we are very short staffed when it comes to mental health. We don't have enough of the outpatient treatment facilities, all of which, by the way, are being worked on in our current state legislative session.
But even if
we will have more.
Even if we build them, if there's no way to compel people who attempt to throw someone off a bridge, just to pick a random example, if you can't compel them to go there, why are we building them?
And that's a follow-through thing. I think you could, if somebody actually did that job to assess that person and and then made them, you can force someone for a longer incompetent stay. But it didn't happen in that case.
Yeah. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Should people Google their symptoms? Let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Gordon, I've done it. I'm sure most listeners have done it. You've probably done it. If you feel something strange, like an erratic heartbeat or, you know, an ache in your neck, should you Google your symptoms before calling the doctor?
So, Dave, good morning. This is actually one of my favorite topics we've ever discussed. And I think it's actually a really important issue because it's something that has actually evolved as information on the internet has evolved over time. So I'll tell you an interesting story. When I started working at Seattle Children's in 2002, doing pediatric heart surgery, and I noticed that parents would come in and they would bring their child, and they had done a lot of research on the internet about their child's heart condition. And what I learned quickly is that there wasn't a lot of good quality information out there at that time, and that parents would basically be reading stories from other parents, and they would come in with a lot of misinformation. And so I actually found myself spending a lot of time undoing what they had learned on the internet and then trying to reteach them what was appropriate. And this was not something that happened occasionally. This was something that happened all the time. In fact, I remember one specific example where two parents who were both engineers, very, very smart people, came in with yellow pads and they had written out pages and pages of questions, all stuff that they had gotten off the internet. Wow. And they had done a lot of research. Unfortunately, most of it was just not good information. So what has happened over time is a lot of websites have developed trying to provide good information. And There are some that are better than others. But here's the thing. If you think about it, what is a doctor's appointment? A doctor's appointment is a transfer of information. So when you walk into the doctor's office, you say, hey, I have this set of problems. And then the physician takes that information and he or she processes it. And then they give you information back. So it's this sharing or transfer of information from patient to doctor and doctor back to patient. Well, what happens when you go onto a website? It's the same thing. It's actually a transfer of information, except in this case, there's not a doctor involved. So it actually puts the processing or interpretation of the information in the hands of somebody who really isn't trained or skilled. This is where the challenge comes, because what happens is people will say, oh, I have a headache. And they'll read that it could be anything from something related to an allergy, you know, a sinus headache, a mild migraine headache, a severe migraine headache, all the way out to brain cancer. Mm-hmm. And people have a tendency, unfortunately, to always think of the worst case
That's
scenario.
Right. They assume it's cancer.
Yeah. And it's one of the challenges that exists in just trying to search information through Google. I do think that some of the major medical centers have actually done a very good job of creating summary information that's useful. So I think the Mayo Clinic has done a very good job. I think the Cleveland Clinic has done a good job creating information resources for patients. Look, information is power. There was an older study that was done in 2008 where 87% of people went to the internet before they went to a doctor, and 90% went to the internet after they saw a doctor. Hmm. So what does that tell you? That people are actually trying to figure out whether or not they need to go to the doctor. And then they're also, after they hear from the doctor, well, maybe there's not adequate transfer of information because the physician is limited, or they think of other questions later, or they just want to know more about their illness. And so they're going back to the internet to get information. So that's really 9 out of 10 people are using the internet to look for health information.
And you would not feel insulted if somebody came into you saying, hey, I looked this up on the internet, and this is what I think it is.
No, I think it's an absolute expectation these days. I think the key thing is really, as a physician, to help guide patients how to use that information, because it can be destructive if it's just anecdotal. It can be destructive if it's not from a reputable medical organization or medical center or a reputable medical business. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, quacks out there, unfortunately, who are preaching inappropriate medical things, which has always been the case throughout history. But, you know, I think that people should use the internet as a resource. They should get the information. It is helpful. That knowledge is power, but they need to also have an ability to consult with somebody who is trained and can put it into perspective or into the appropriate context, which is very difficult to get off of the internet without the experience. Especially the primary care doctors, any experienced primary care doctor will tell you that oftentimes just by walking in the room or watching a patient walk to the room, that they already have a good idea of what the diagnosis is before the patient even says anything to them. And that's part of the art of medicine, the skill and experience that a physician develops over time. And there is a lot to know, and there is an art to medicine for sure, that a computer currently is not able to replace.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's talk some real estate here with Matthew Gardner, Chief Economist for Windermere Real Estate. And it looks like the new figures show the housing market came roaring back after the snow, huh?
It did. It had quite a significant pop. And essentially, I think a lot of sales were held over because we all remember Snowmageddon. And I think a lot of the market essentially stopped for a period of time. That then came rushing back. But also, as importantly, there was a significant drop in mortgage rates. We saw them drop by almost 0.5%. Massive, massive move. So I think a lot of people that were on the fences, so obviously jumped off them, and we're actually going to see a real spring market, which is interesting because we did not see that last year.
So it looks healthy according to the numbers, but I have to bounce this off you because we've had a big discussion ever since the Como television report called Seattle is Dying, whether this is a healthy community worth investing in or whether our government leaders have just written off the problems and we're going to have to live with them. I mean, that seems to be the overriding question in people's minds. So, first of all, what's your take on that whole Seattle is dying meme?
We have significant problems. There's no question about it. And I think, yes, has the city council dropped the ball? No question about it. I think we need to spend a lot more effort, a lot more energy on trying to address this. It is not unique, however, to Seattle. We see it in Portland. We see it very much so in San Francisco. So it's endemic in a lot of markets up and down the West Coast. Comfortable place to be, for people to be. If they're not having anyone pushing back on them, then they're going to stay. So can that have a significant effect on the housing market? Well, I think if you look, you got to look at two markets. Certainly the downtown market, sure, I think it can. However, in terms of the city as a whole or the region, probably I think the effects are less consequential when it comes to housing prices. So I don't expect to see that having a major impact, but it is something that's hanging out there which needs to be addressed,
yeah.
And it is clearly not happening.
Another controversy, perennial controversy, is Sound Transit. Has it been worth the money? And we were talking about Amazon's decision to move into Bellevue, which I think come up in our discussions before. And John Chalmanak, actually former Cairo employee, now the mayor of Bellevue, pointed out that a lot of development on the east side is being driven by that light rail line now. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, I do. If you think about it, well, once the line gets opened, depending on when you believe that's going to be, they're still saying 2024. Imagine a situation whereby if you are, let's say, an employee at Amazon, you can be in your office in Seattle, and 12 minutes later, you could be at your office in Bellevue. That is very, very significant. So is it driving that? Very much so. And I think Bellevue continues, and it's been that way, I would argue, since the late 1990s, emerging as an independent city, one that doesn't necessarily run to the tune of Seattle. That happened when Symetra Financial opened up their global headquarters in, I believe, 1999. Is it growing? Yeah. Is it autonomous? Absolutely. Has it also got the space to develop? More so than Seattle? Very much so. Right. So I think when you see Amazon expanding there, they're not going to replace the Long Island Sound facility, which they pulled back from. They're just going to spread those people out into Seattle, Bellevue, or into Austin and into other markets, San Francisco, I would imagine, as well. So, yeah, I mean, Bellevue is going to certainly benefit, I would argue, dramatically from light rail when it occurs.
Okay. So, looking for bargains, somebody who's looking to buy a house and has been discouraged by all this news of the market coming roaring back and prices going up, there are still some undiscovered places or underappreciated places. Perhaps.
Yeah, I think not undiscovered, but certainly underappreciated.
Yeah.
I think there's two ways I would look at this. One, we already talked about mass transit, light rail. I am still remarkably excited about markets which are proximate to future light rail stations. An example is with Roosevelt University District, Northgate. Those are markets which, again, historically, relatively speaking, cheap. However, they are going to be benefiting from light rail as of 2021, not that far away.
No.
And so I think that we know we're not going to build any more roads. We need to move people around. I would be, without a doubt, looking at these markets. And even further down the road, North Seattle Shoreline, Mount Lake Terrace, light rail not scheduled to be there until about 3 years later, about 2024. But again, we're certainly already seeing some investors start to look around those markets to start picking off some houses which they believe longer term are going to see more significant upside in terms of price than many others.
I look at what happens in other areas of the country. We have some relatives living in Washington, D.C., for example, where that light rail system has created some really remarkable suburbs that have a mix of apartment buildings and single-family homes, but you hop on a train, and in a half hour, you're in Washington, D.C. And it's a very appealing lifestyle to a lot of people.
Oh, very much so. And we, as a nation, we're comfortable commuting up to 35 minutes each way. That's the level which has been decided.
That's what studies tell you?
Correct. That we're okay. Up
35 minutes is the golden.
But it has to be 35 minutes, David. It can't be 20 minutes one day and an hour and a half the next.
Yeah, right.
And clearly, mass transit has, depending on the form of it, has that capacity. So I think, we will create these emerging neighborhoods. I would also argue to a degree we need to look at density and whether the rezoning that's being talked about now is sufficient enough to meet that demand. I mean, you could argue that where some markets will say, okay, you can build up to 65 feet, well, perhaps you should be able to build up to 90 feet. Perhaps we can actually add more density than is currently being suggested. But it's not just areas around future mass transit options, which I think are important as well. There are other ones. I mean, go back. It was several years ago, for example, let's look at Columbia City, Georgetown. Historically very underappreciated. Certainly that is clearly not the case today.
No.
They have already emerged. And so I think there's some other ones which I would look at as well. which would be Burien, Beacon Hill, Allentown. I would also argue White Center, south of Delridge in West Seattle, as areas, again, which, relatively speaking, are cheap. Mm-hmm. Sales prices are still below $500,000, mm-hmm. certainly not cheap, but everything is relative. And I think those are areas, again, it's these first ex-urban markets, first rings around our cities. They're the ones that I think are going to benefit in the long run, more so than in further suburban Sammamish Plateau, Issaquah, these kinds of areas.
So the prosperity, because I know Burien has, you know, sort of a mixed reputation, same thing with White Center. You think the prosperity trend is strong enough to really reach into those areas as well? Huh?
I think it can be. But again, you got to look at it not on a, I can buy a house now and it's going to double in value in 18 months.
Yeah.
No. I mean, you should always be taking the longer view. Your house is your home first and an asset second. I've always said that. But yeah, I mean, I really think that we've seen it before, as I mentioned, in Columbia City, not necessarily several years ago, a great place to be. Now, you're seeing townhomes there trading in the high $800,000 price range.
Yeah.
But again, also proximity to mass transit, proximity to downtown. So yeah, I would argue over time, we'll see this. We'll see capital expenditures. We'll see retail start moving in there, which essentially always follows population. Start seeing some good, always watch restaurants. When you start seeing good restaurants open, always a very good sign.
That's the signal.
Yes, it is.
There are some great restaurants in Columbia City.
Oh, that's some of the best ones I've eaten in the last year, both down there, yes.
Matthew Gardner, Chief Economist for Windermere. Matthew, thank you.
You're always welcome.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now. 13-year-old Gavin Mabes was with some friends at a skate park when they encountered a young boy who was there with his mother celebrating his fifth birthday. And CBS's Steve Hartman has what happened next.
How do kids behave when no grown-ups are around? Danette Mabes of South Brunswick, New Jersey says you never really know.
Because you're not watching him at that moment and at that time.
She had always just assumed her son was good.
Right.
Until recently, when 13-year-old Gavin Mabes got caught on tape showing his true character.
Oh, my God!
Gavin and some middle school friends had just arrived at a skate park. The park was empty, except for little Carter Brunel, who was here with his mother celebrating his fifth birthday. Carter is autistic. Big groups of older kids can make him nervous, so his mom, Kristen, was fully prepared to get him out of there. She just wasn't prepared for what happened next.
I don't know. They've really just shocked me. It was unlike any experience I think I've ever had.
You know how middle school kids sometimes operate like they're in a pack? Well, that's pretty much what happened here. Gavin led the way and the others followed. The only surprise was that Gavin didn't start trouble. He started a friendship.
This kid's already better than me.
Gavin's just going around with him and making him feel special. And the rest of his friends kind of followed suit and then started singing happy birthday to him.
Happy birthday!
That really blew me away.
Oh,
because you just want to see the kindness in the world. And I wanted Carter to have a good birthday.
It was such a great birthday.
Yeah.
And such a kind deed. Even the local police department responded.
And we're going to throw you guys a pizza party next week over at school.
But here's the best part. Since their first meeting, Gavin and the middle schoolers have continued to go out of their way to play with Carter.
How you doing?
He was just so happy and he made us all happy.
So fun to be around.
Yeah. He's rad.
Yeah. And as for the moms,
you're awesome.
For them, this was a moment of parenting utopia, where the only thing better than seeing your kid treated kindly is knowing that your kid is treating others kindly. Even when you're not watching.
That was so cool.
I was just so proud of him.
You want a race?
He's good.
You did it right.
Thank you.
Steve Hartman, on the road, in South Brunswick, New Jersey.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill, and here he is, Rick Riz, wrapping up yesterday's Mariners game against the White Sox.
12 runs today on 12 hits. Holy smokes, they have scored 84 runs on the season in their first 11 games of the year. The Mariners go to 9-2 on the season, their best start ever.
An offensive juggernaut. A Seattle team is an offensive juggernaut.
They're walloping people, and yesterday, you know who it was? The Vogel wagon.
I know. I heard
the Vogel wagon got fired up.
Cayuga.
Dave's so excited about this because he has a signed baseball from him.
I know. Yeah. He might have been the person that spurred Daniel Vogelbach's rise to prominence.
Could be a little good luck dust.
Yep, absolutely. So, still the best team in baseball?
Yes.
I'm just trying to think of any reason why this wouldn't just continue for the rest of the season. I can't come up with anything.
They're not this good.
They're not this good.
They're not this good.
You have to explain the concept of a baseball team being good and yet not good.
Well, they're really good right now because they've averaged 7.5 runs. We'll see if they keep it up. And it's great. I would not say that, hey, this is what projects for the rest of the season. This is probably the best they're going to play, which is great. I mean, it's incredible. But the idea that this is going to be a 116-win team like the Mariners were in 2001.
Which opponent? Do you think would truly test them?
Well, Houston and Boston have better rosters. Houston and Boston are better franchises. And actually, that's the reason that the Mariners started looking ahead to 2020 and 2021 in this past offseason. And that's why they traded James Paxton for a guy we haven't seen yet in Justice Sheffield. Those two teams projected out over 162-game season. I would think that even now, given what we've seen, Houston and Boston will end up with better records than the Mariners.
Well, what's the likely outcome for the Mariners as the season goes on? Is it injuries? Is it just losing their juice, their mojo?
Regression to the mean.
Okay.
That's generally what somebody would look, because you're able to project how all of these Mariners were going to play. You can look at it, and that's not some sort of ironclad black box that's going to spit it out. Guys have career years. There are times where guys exceed expectations and they're going to get Kyle Seager back, which will help them. Mm-hmm. But guys right now are playing pretty far ahead of what their projection were. Daniel Vogelbach is hitting really well right now. And Mitch Haniger had a 9-game hitting streak going into yesterday's game. Over the course of a 162-game season, some of these guys are not going to keep playing at this clip. What we've seen is a hot streak, or they've outperformed what we generally should expect. And over the course of 162 games, their performance is probably going to come down. Also, the Mariners' bullpen is a flaming bag of dog poop.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Please explain.
Because when you try to stomp it to get the fire out, when it gets set alight, like your shoe ends up a mess.
Oh.
The bullpen's not good. Now, the good news is that's the easiest thing to fix. That's the easiest thing. If you really did get into a situation where you're like, man, it's August or it's July, and we've got a shot to win 90-95 games, you can go out and pay for a couple of relievers. That's
is that
something
what you're putting them at, 90-95 games?
Well, that's what
they're
playing.
Why not make it a nice even 100?
No, I think they're going to win about 80 games.
Both scoffed at 100. It's 5 more games than he just said.
Well, I don't think they're going to win 90 or 95 games.
Oh, so you're being optimistic.
If you were in that situation in July, where you were projecting to win that many, you could make some short-term upgrades to the bullpen. That's possible, where it just cost you some money.
All right.
Well, why don't you just make sure that your starting pitchers continue to strike people out, you know, with like 9 pitches per inning and can go the whole game?
How about we get you out there?
Dave is now the pitching coach.
Start spitting fire.
No,
we've got a young flame-throwing right-hander.
I think I'm up to 38 miles an hour.
There we go. We've never seen anything like this, folks.
That's it, because, you know, when you throw that slow, the batters really anticipate, and they whiff it every time.
Messes up their timing.
Yeah, exactly. When the ball is dropping straight out of the sky, it's impossible.
It's an
entirely
different rotation than they're used to.
Absolutely. Yeah, Dave would have be the only pitcher, I think, to only have the EFUS pitch as his one and only pitch.
The EFUS pitch. It's what you, when you lob it.
You basically go straight up in the air.
You go for trajectory as opposed to velocity. Yeah, it's legal.
So if it crosses the strike zone.
Did you ever watch Bugs Bunny when he went to town on the Gas House Gorillas?
Yeah, he played every position. What about Brewster's Millions? That was Richard Pryor's strikeout pitch.
Right. Well, truth be told, that's what I modeled my style on, yes. Can we talk about Jack Sikma?
Sure.
NBA Hall of Fame?
Elected to the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, a center out of Illinois Wesleyan, NAIA school. Sonics drafted him number 8 overall, 1977.
Jack Sikma.
There was a headline that read, Jack who? Jack Sikma. Yeah. And elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame. When he was inserted into the starting lineup, it kind of became a catalyst for a transformation of Seattle's franchise. They were, I think, 5-17. And then Lenny Wilkins took over, and Lenny Wilkins put Jack Sikma in the starting lineup, and they ended up playing for the NBA championship that year, and they ended up winning it the next year when he averaged 15 points, 12 rebounds.
Those were the years.
He also was the source of what was one of the greatest quotes I've ever seen, which Larry Stone dug up. Zoli Volcek, who was the general manager at the time, somebody asked him, is there anybody you'd trade Jack Sigma for? He said, I wouldn't trade Jack Sigma for the reincarnation of Marilyn Monroe in my bedroom.
Wow.
That was Zoli Volcek. Yeah. Would you trade him for it? I wouldn't trade him for the reincarnation of Marilyn Monroe in my bedroom.
That is a classic.
Hey, sorry to hear about your team Auburn getting out of the
I know. They got jobbed by the refs.
That was your pick.
Yeah, they got hosed.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. It's rigged.
It's not rigged.
Everything's rigged.
Mistakes happen. Texas Tech, the vaunted basketball powerhouse of Texas Tech. Did you see the people in Lubbock didn't know how to handle winning?
No.
Started tipping cars over, setting
That's
stuff
crazy.
On fire.
Well, why would you do that?
Yeah, because they're from Texas.
Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Seattle's Morning News, Monday morning, and time to consult with CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger, whose job is to make us all jillionaires. But before we get to the latest financial advice, I wanted to ask you about a couple of presidential appointments to the Federal Reserve Board, Stephen Moore and Herman Cain, and people I've heard commenting, Jill, are concerned that the president is trying to politicize the Federal Reserve Board. To what end?
Well, okay. Presidents in general have always had, I think, bad feelings around the Federal Reserve, meaning that they can feel these things, but they don't always act upon it. So what the president has done that's different than other presidents prior is that he's been very outspoken about his displeasure around the Federal Reserve. What he would like at this point, and what he's saying, is he believes that the economy needs the Fed's help, and that the Federal Reserve should be not just sitting still and not raising rates, but that the Fed should be actively cutting interest rates and potentially considering buying bonds like they did after the financial crisis. So that's known as loose monetary policy, meaning that the Federal Reserve, which is independent, right? So the president appoints Fed governors but doesn't control the Fed governors, and the Fed basically reports in to Congress, but it is supposed to be independent, and the president would really like the Federal Reserve to help juice up the economy. Now, the answer to that, though, is from the Federal Reserve standpoint, that would be irresponsible right now because the economy is doing fine. It's not that it's okay. It's growing probably by about, let's call it 2.25%, maybe 2.5% this year. Last year, we grew by about 3%. And we've slowed down because the effects of the tax cuts have started to wear off. And the Fed is not interested in lowering interest rates right now because it feels that doing so would actually be helping to foster some inflation. And they're worried about that.
So is this something that would, for example, this policy would boost the stock market even higher? Is that how this would?
If the Fed came out and we started to hear the Fed governors give speeches about, we plan to boost the economy by cutting interest rates or by buying bonds. If the cost of borrowing were to drop, that would definitely help the stock market. Mm-hmm. Now, from the economy side, you have to wonder, well, why would we be cutting rates? There is no emergency. The economy's growing. It's okay. It's fine. It's not doing terribly. It's doing just fine. We had a good jobs report on Friday. We are averaging 180,000 jobs a month for the first 3 months of this year. And, you know, we are coming up to the 10th anniversary of this economic expansion. So from an economist's point of view, to cut rates right now would not really make a ton of sense.
Okay. Let's talk about financial literacy. You are concerned that we have raised a generation of young people who not only haven't learned to sew or, build furniture in the wood shop, but also can't control their finances. How bad is it?
Well, we have I wouldn't even say kids. Adult financial literacy is just not very good. By the way, happy Financial Literacy Month, Dave. I should have started with that. And I know your card is in the mail tonight.
Does it come with cake?
April is Financial Literacy Month, which means we're getting a lot of surveys out about how much people understand about various financial terms and concepts. And what we have learned is that frankly, American adults have done a little bit better in the borrowing and saving on those concepts. They do a lot less well on insurance, investing, and comprehending risk. And the answer may be that we have to think differently about how we educate people about finances. A lot of people will say, you know, we ought to have financial literacy in schools. People, you know, we cannot have kids graduating from high school without understanding how to balance a checkbook. And listen, that's better than nothing. But actually, research shows that the best thing we can do for kids is to improve our mathematics curricula. And if we were to do that and weave in personal financial concepts into mathematics, that is the key to actually improving financial decision making in adults.
And the biggest mistake young people are making when it comes to financial decisions?
Well, I think that the biggest mistake, and I encounter this all the time when I hear from people on my radio show and my podcast, is that people really don't understand how to judge risk. And that's fascinating to me, because even when you tell them, here's the probability, their eyes glaze over, because even just the word probability starts to make no sense to them. So I think the big issue that we really need to focus on is like a very intro level statistics. Even if I say the word statistics, your eyes are rolling back in your head. I can see it. I see all of you out there right now. But just to connect the dots, that to me would be so helpful.
Jill Schlesinger, Senior Business Analyst. She joins us every Monday. Jill, thank you very much.
Take care.
Inspiration can strike when you least expect it, which is why Renton has a new downtown rooftop dragon. Dyer Oxley, host of the Northwest Nerd podcast, talked to one of the dragon wranglers.
I think it was more just because I love dragons than anything.
That's Marsha Rollinger. She's a member of Renton's Arts Commission. Now, about 3 years ago, Marsha and a few others on the commission, they were hunting around downtown for a public art opportunity. And at the time, they were trying to convince city leaders that they needed more funding.
Like, okay, let's look around downtown and come up with potential projects we could do that could show them if we had more funding, you know, we could execute much larger projects.
And that's when it happened. Inspiration. They were hanging out in a coffee shop on the corner of 3rd Street and Wells. Marsha stared at this building across the street. It wasn't anything too imposing, just an old brick building, and frankly, it'd seen more than 100 years. Perhaps a couple earthquakes.
I mean, the building's sound, it just has, there's old scars. There was a crack that was repaired at the top. It looked like something hit the building from the top pretty hard.
Marsha took a photo of that building and started photoshopping some options for the council, just as an example. But there was really only one idea that she liked as an example.
I love dragons. I grew up playing Dungeons and Dragons.
A dragon, and a big one, as if the beast was causing the building to sink into the ground.
Renton's pretty diverse. We have dragons in almost every culture, and Wizards of the Coast is headquartered in Renton, so it just seemed like a dragon made the most sense. The whole downtown core right now is pretty nerd-centric, as far as there's the Comic Hut, Game Explosion, D-pad gaming. There's a lot of geek-oriented things.
So Marsha headed down to City Hall with the dragon mock-up, shuffled into a handful of other public art options.
It was just supposed to be a demonstration, but at the end of our presentation, Councilmember Randy Corman's like, hey, we need to make this dragon happen.
And that kicked off a 3-year journey to construct a giant rooftop dragon for downtown Renton. Western Neon, a Seattle sign company, helped with the metalwork and the lighting, because dragons gotta light up after all. And just this past week, the dragon slowly began to perch on its new nest. But it will officially be welcomed into the community Saturday with a grand dragon lighting, along with a few other events.
So it's just a bunch of fun activities for nerds. Us fellow nerds.
Dyer Ox is with us now. So who owns the building? And are they cool with the dragon on top of it?
There's a landlord who does own the building, and they went and checked with them first. They even checked with the tenants because upstairs is apartments. So someone's going to have a head over their window, and someone's going to have a tail over their window. And according to Marcia, they actually think it's pretty cool that that's going to be a feature now.
I'm looking at the pictures right now on MyNorthwest.com. So cool. I think this was early on, Dave, if you're looking at this picture. And then later on, you can see where it lights up. Let me get to the picture. So you can see these at MyNorthwest.com, all of the building. But yeah, there's the neon inside the mouth of the dragon.
And those change color. So depending on the season or the mood, there's a remote control that will be held at City Hall, and they can come down and click it on and off when they like.
God forbid this causes traffic distractions.
Oh, Sully.
Won't somebody think of the driver?
We'll put a privacy screen in front of it, Chris. So how do the people – this is an apartment building then.
Yeah, yeah. So and it's an old – I looked it up. It's about 109 years old or so, and it's an old Mason construction, you know, masonry, like brick building. So it has sunk in – like a lot of the buildings in downtown.
So how do the residents feel about being in a building that was picked for the dragon because it looks like it's falling apart?
Well, it's structurally sound. So, I mean, obviously they probably can't rent this building out without it actually being sound to live in. And it doesn't look like it's entirely – like if you look at that side of the building, it doesn't look like it's entirely just falling apart. But you can tell. Like the Nisqually quake came and – there was a little crack that formed at the top, and they cemented it.
Yeah.
There's a little dip in there.
It's not dramatic, but enough to make it look like the weight of the dragon.
I've walked by. I've been to that coffee shop. I've never noticed it before, but I guess if you're an artist, you're looking out for that.
So is this a permanent thing now?
It's permanent. It will be there all year round.
Wow.
Yeah, and I guess it's no surprise to me. I did not prompt her at all to say geek or nerd or anything like that, and I realize I'm the one reporting on this, but I've long reported – or argued that Renton is the nerdiest town in this region. Yeah, it's not only that comic shop, two retro games. They've got an 8-bit arcade.
They got
on
pinball
that
too, right?
They've got pinball right down in there. They've got a sci-fi themed pizza shop, and then just a short jaunt down the way, you've got Wizards of the Coast. And I don't care who you are, if you put any amount of engineers in a building like at Boeing, you're going to have a whole cluster of nerds there.
That's right. Dyer Oxley, who hosts the award-winning Northwest Nerd Podcast. Thank you, Dyer.